Yulia Zizkina is a policy and advocacy attorney specializing in information policy and public international law. She is from Ukraine originally and is now based in the New York City metropolitan area. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about one of the, if not the most important topic, I think, to cover, and one which doesn't get nearly as much traction as it should, and that is the potential seizure of Russian central bank assets, which certainly people who are watching this channel and listen to the previous episodes with Timothy Ash will know is central to Ukrainian victory and to a stable rebuilding of the economy. But Yulia, welcome to the channel.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
And I've watched some of the material. You've, of course, been on panels with Tim Ash, who people watching this channel will know he's an extraordinary advocate for Ukraine, but also talks a lot of sense. Let's start with the central bank assets. And there has been a lot of talk about it, and there's a huge amount of arguments put forward as to why not to do it. Let's start with the why it should happen. Why is the seizure of the central bank assets and passing them over to Ukraine an absolutely critical step to take?
Well, there are numerous reasons. I could probably fill up this entire episode just talking about the reasons for them, but I'll give some overarching reasons, some based in justice and some based in practicality. Starting with the practicality, this is a huge amount of money that would be a game changer for the war in Ukraine if they were to be seized and they were to be used appropriately. And by appropriately, I mean what Ukraine's needs are. There needs to be a focus at the forefront of what Ukraine needs to win this war, which so far, unfortunately, hasn't been the case. The economic side of this war is just as important as the military side. If Ukraine can't sustain itself economically, if it can't keep its economy running, its government running, or rebuilding critical infrastructure or providing services to its people, it cannot sustain itself as a country, no matter what the gains on the military battlefield are. Unfortunately, we're seeing it become harder and harder to pass aid for Ukraine, as most of your listeners will probably know on this channel with what's happening in the US right now. But at the same time, we're sitting on this gigantic source of Russian money. It's almost amazing to me that more than 2 years after this war has been started by Russia, we are still protecting its money more than our own Western taxpayers' money and our own national security interests. So that's the practical side of it. The bigger picture, I think, too, is that this is a measure of such important justice for Ukraine and for the international community. Ukraine doesn't just need money. It needs, for the sake of its people, it needs justice. It needs Russia to pay. It needs the aggressor to pay. That is the whole point of reparations. I think it's also an important precedent to set for the international community. It's one of deterrence, it's one of prioritizing victims' rights, and it's one of upholding the international rule-based order over an aggressor's bank account. And that's really what it comes down to.
Well, we're going to analyze some of the issues that are being given for not doing this, and many of them seem quite sort of obscure, abstract, and legalistic. But there is a fear, of course, that actually the real reason this isn't happening is because large Western corporations are putting pressure on various governments for fear of Russia reciprocating and seizing their assets, which may still be in Russia. Let's tackle that fear first off. How much foundation is there that it's lobbying by large multinational corporations that are actually, you know, gumming this up and slowing it down?
That is a huge part of it, yes. So there are, I believe, it's about $100 billion worth of Western private assets of countries still operating in Russia. Most companies have withdrawn out of Russia, and those that haven't, they stay there at their own risk. If anything, they started their operations in Russia at their own risk, knowing full well of the landscape that they were entering into, arguably even since the war in Georgia. Frankly, these are poor business decisions. And now they are looking to policymakers and to the government to bail them out of these poor decisions. For the companies that haven't already withdrawn from Russia, the time of expropriation really has already arrived. That ship has long sailed. In April, Putin actually signed a decree allowing Russia to expropriate property from what Russia deems as unfriendly countries. And by unfriendly, that decree means any country that has levied sanctions against it, which is the vast majority of the Western world. So under that decree, Russia has proceeded to seize Finnish, German, French, and Danish companies by calling those actions a countermeasure, obviously an unlawful countermeasure. The other part of this is that most of the assets, the private assets that Russia has already seized, have been put under the control of Putin's cronies. This is a huge incentive. And in fact, the expropriation of these Western companies has proven to be such a boon to those oligarchs close to Putin that there's been infighting over who gets what. And there's already internal pressure from Russia's elite that these expropriations continue. So, given the already rapid pace of expropriation and Putin's own motivation to continue it, there's very little logical reason to believe that the decision to seize Russia's sovereign assets would amount to anything more than continuing the confiscations that are already inevitable. I guess the bigger picture here too is that even if they haven't already been expropriated, those countries who took the risk of investing in Russia should not be hijacking the national security of the West and of Europe because they're worried about their profitability. That's not a good policy decision. We'll also add that Western businesses have recourse for expropriation if this does happen to them. The most effective recourse, I think, would be to challenge the illegal expropriation through investment arbitration tribunals. Russia has 64 bilateral investment treaties that are currently in force. So this is more likely to be successful going this route than to be prevented through some kind of arrangement with the Russian government, or hoping that the Russian government won't expropriate assets if we won't take their sovereign funds. Russia has a demonstrated track record of violating any and all agreements and law. There's really no viable path for Western businesses to keep functioning in Russia based on the rule of law.
And that's the irony, isn't it? That was going to be my next question, but I think you've pretty much answered it. Russia is intent on tearing up the international order. It is not a rules-based society. You talked about the expropriation of foreign assets in Russia, but there's another interesting angle to this, and that is oligarchs have started expropriating businesses of Russians in Russia. And soon you're going to have oligarchs fighting it out over the remaining assets between themselves. Things are getting extremely ugly there. Why should we be upholding the so-called highest best practice of international order and essentially protecting Russia, a society which is intent on tearing down this international rules-based order that essentially has held sway since the Second World War?
Well, we have no other choice. It really depends what we want our collective values to be going forward. Russia has left the security and the international rules-based order in the hands of the West. Russia has never been a law-abiding country. Never in its history, for example, has it paid reparations for its illegal conquest or any illegal wars that it's provoked. So the West needs to respond. We can't just sit idly by. This sets a very, very dangerous precedent for the future. And these sovereign reserves are a huge part of that. Other aggressors, such as China, the Islamic regime, are looking to see what will happen with this. If we don't react strongly and if we continue self-deterring and keep adopting this policy of self-defeatism almost, that is going to be what the escalation is. Not responding strongly to Russia, but responding in weakness.
And one of the arguments has been made here, and I think this was made very forcefully by Tim Ash, and that is that the IMF is sustaining a dangerous myth that the Ukrainian war economy is sustainable without the resort to using these immobilized Russian central bank assets. And he's done some neat calculations there, which actually the requirements over the next 3 years, which is the projected period that this war potentially will carry on until Russia is completely exhausted. Now, we can't know that for sure, but I think it's a fairly conservative estimate that it could continue for the next 1 to 3 years. Those seized assets would seem to cover a lot of the expenditure required, as you say, both for emergency services, various sort of, government employees and so on, but also the purchase of essential munitions and air defense.
That's exactly right. I don't know what reality the IMF is living in, but it's not the same one as many economists and other attorneys are. I don't know practically where the Western world will get the money to sustain Ukraine without these frozen assets. Already, the estimate is that this war will be about 100 billion per year on military needs, I think 50 billion per year for long-term reconstruction. Where exactly is that money going to come from? The answer, I'm frankly very skeptical that Europe will have this amount of funds. I'm also very skeptical that the US will continue supporting, especially seeing as how hard it's been for the past 6 months to pass a $60 billion national security bill. And I will also point out that that national security bill, that 60 billion, most of it, I think over 80% of that money actually stays in the US. So here we're talking about the financial economic needs of Ukraine and rebuilding. That's going to be a very hard sell, I think, for Western taxpayers to continue fronting that cost over the next however many years. So there really is no other option. And it's a very dangerous myth for the IMF and for others to keep perpetuating this. Again, as I mentioned before, Ukraine's needs and Ukraine's calculations and what Ukraine actually needs need to be the starting point, not whatever scheme the G7 cooks up, but what Ukraine actually needs. It's a needs-based assessment. I would say there's already a $41 billion deficit, according to Ukrainian authorities. And 9.5 billion of which is just critical, immediate reconstruction needs. Already, 100% of Ukraine's tax revenue is going towards funding military costs and funding military-related objectives such as prosthetics for its soldiers, for veterans support. There's already a deficit. How are we going to raise even more money for long-term reconstruction?
And that hides actually some of the reality, doesn't it? Because it's estimated that up to 20% of all expenditure on the war effort is actually provided by private organizations, by this vigorous civic society that engages both internally in Ukraine and, of course, with external volunteers, donors, and so on. So the overall need is actually larger than the Ukrainian budget on paper.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And it's amazing that we've had so much civil society support and so much donations. And I think this really speaks to what the public perceives as the importance of Ukraine, the fact that the public and regular people are still supporting, but that isn't a long-term strategy. Just necessarily that private money is probably going to decrease over time as this war drags on, and it doesn't seem as pressing in and in the forefront. This is just what happens. So government needs to step in, policymakers need to step in.
If we're going to look at the top reasons of why this isn't happening, are things like political inertia, the lack of will to win on the side of many Western countries, or are we going to look at sort of, let's say the corporate reasons as the big ones, or is there also disquiet that these funds would be used for the war effort and not reconstruction? Is it possible that many countries would be more comfortable entirely seizing those assets if they were put forward for rebuilding as opposed to munitions and war spend? And I guess the follow-on question is that realistic? Is there any point in talking about rebuilding until there is some sense of victory?
Okay, so I'll touch on the political will question afterwards, and I'll start on military aid versus rebuilding. I Honestly, don't believe there's a difference in the calculation of countries whether or not to use this money for military or rebuilding. I don't think either one makes them more or less comfortable, at least in my discussions. Legally, it's a little bit of a different calculation analysis, but I think both are justifiable. In terms of reconstruction, I think there's this misperception that reconstruction is something that happens, quote unquote, after the war is over. First of all, who knows when that will be? And second of all, that's just simply not true. Reconstruction and rebuilding is an ongoing process. Russia continually targets critical infrastructure, as we've seen just this past week. And that critical structure needs to be continuously rebuilt in order for Ukraine to sustain its defense and to protect its civilians. Without continuously rebuilding, it will lose the war. The damage will become irreversible. So we don't wait for Ukraine to be demolished into bits and pieces until we start reconstructing. We have to keep doing it. We have to keep rebuilding its railways, for example, to even for them to deliver critical aid, humanitarian aid, medical supplies, heating, energy, electricity. The needs are endless, and Russia knows this. And so these assets needs to be a core strategy for not just Ukraine's economic needs, but also its urgent on the ground needs for rebuilding.
Do we know also the full extent of these assets? Are they fully logged? Where are they held? And also, they're accruing interest, but there's been no attempt to pass that interest across. I would have thought that is less contentious than the core assets.
So I'll start a little bit with where these assets are and where they're held. I'll backtrack a little bit. So we're talking about here foreign currency reserves. The vast majority of foreign currency reserves in these assets are usually held in the form of securities. But throughout the past 2 years, a lot of these securities have already matured into cash. They are dispersed. The total $300 billion amount is dispersed through G7 governments, but in jurisdictions, but the chunk of which is held by Euroclear. Euroclear reported that it holds about 190 billion euro of the assets, and Euroclear is a clearinghouse that's located in Belgium, but it manages the holdings of other governments. So, but that's not the full piece of this, actually. We can't just say 190 billion is held by Euroclear and then, wipe our hands and say, well, it's up to Euroclear. We can't really do much. That's not quite true. Because a lot of this money has matured into cash, there is actually an argument to be made that non-euro denominated holdings, other jurisdictions can assert their jurisdiction over that. So the way that this works is that other governments, through their correspondent bank, Euroclear correspondent banks, often holds their specific currency denominations in Euroclear. So I guess in terms of the US, this means that there's actually not just what the US says is about like 5 billion directly held in the US. There's also about, I believe, 17 billion in US currency denominated accounts that are held in Euroclear correspondent banks. And since this money is held in US currency and it falls under US sanctions, there is a nexus to US jurisdiction. It needs to go through OFAC for that money to be moved, and this is where that nexus comes in. So we need to reframe the discussion a little bit. When people say, well, these 190 billion, these are Belgian assets, they're Euroclear's assets. Well, that's not really true. Is it really a Belgian Euroclear asset if the US or the UK or Canada can exercise their jurisdiction over it? So I think this is another potential way to get that money. Without waiting for the EU or Euroclear to make a decision, because we do actually have lawful claims over it. I do want to add one more thing, too. In regards to knowing exactly where this money is, this is something that's kind of a problem in that Western governments haven't really provided a clear idea of the breakdown. And that's an issue because that's really the core starting point. I think providing greater transparency about the amounts and the locations of these immobilized state assets, that would actually be a crucial step towards confiscating them, because we would know where they are, we would know what type they are, and it would also enable a better understanding of how much or where the missing or yet undetected assets might be and how they might be targeted. So I think part of the reluctance on the part of governments to disclose this information also ties into their reluctance to seize it.
And there's two prominent arguments which I've heard a number of times at various events that focus on where this topic comes up. One is people vociferously will say, but this is against international law. And these often tend to be the same people who will tend to amplify or repeat Kremlin talking points, it seems, but that certainly is a very prominent argument, certainly amongst, I would say, some leftists, also some on the right, and it's very much a propaganda talking point too. But of course, it is debated by lawyers. It's not pure propaganda. So I'd like to unpack that. The other one, of course, the other argument is that if we go down this route, then it will degrade the reputation of the Western financial system and it will incur reciprocal measures. Is there any basis to these two arguments or can we demolish them fairly effectively?
We can absolutely demolish them fairly effectively. And in fact, they have been demolished very effectively in the past 2 years. It's unfortunate that these misperceptions keep being circulated. And perhaps later I'll talk about why I think that is. But first, I'll start with just setting the record straight about the legal basis. Yes, some lawyers may disagree, but they haven't mounted a good defense as to why they disagree. So let me explain it a little bit, and I'll go step by step. There's absolutely no doubt about the illegality of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the occupation of its territory. That's the starting point. Russia's violated the most fundamental rules of international law that are enshrined in the UN Charter, which prohibit the use of force against the territorial integrity or political sovereignty of another state. That fact is not disputed in the Western world. It's been recognized not just by the UN in multiple resolutions, but also by the ICJ, which ordered Russia back in March in a binding ruling to desist its war of aggression, which Russia obviously did not. So there is already legal recognition that Russia is waging a war of aggression. It's also under international law. Step two is not disputed that Russia owes reparations for the damages that it has caused. So, in effect, Russia has violated two obligations so far: one, the aggression itself, and two, the duty to compensate and to pay reparations. So, you may have already heard this term, but in the face of such a blatant violation of international legal obligations, international law permits other countries to respond with countermeasures. So, what are countermeasures? Countermeasures are a well-established doctrine in international law. They're delineated by the UN International Law Commission's articles on the responsibility of states. These articles represent the most authoritative statement of customary international law. And they're frequently cited in the judgments by the ICJ and other international tribunals. So, it is not just some idea that lawyers cooked up. It is part of international law. So, just to be a little bit more specific about this and what the argument is, lawful countermeasures are measures that would be unlawful if they were imposed against an innocent state. So, for example, one that hasn't violated its international obligations, but they are permitted if they're being taken against an offending state and are intended to induce that offending state to comply with its obligations. So, in this case, when a wrongdoing state breaches its obligations, so it doesn't cease its internationally wrongful conduct, or it doesn't make full reparation for the injury caused by that conduct, the injured state and third-party states may adopt countermeasures to induce that offending state to comply with the duties. And here, the word induce actually means to persuade someone to do something or to cause someone something to happen. That is the definition. So, in this case, transferring Russia's sovereign assets to an international compensation mechanism would cause Russia to comply with its obligation to make reparations to Ukraine. And by that same token, it would also serve as an inducement or an incentive to Russia to cease its wrongful conduct of aggression and to bring itself back into compliance. So on both of these bases, the countermeasures would be lawful. I also think it's worth pointing out, and I think this piece is missing in discussion sometimes, is that states have a positive duty, or in other words, a duty to act in accordance with it's Article 41 of the Articles on Responsibility of States, which says states shall cooperate to bring an end through lawful means any serious breach. So this means that third-party states aren't only entitled to take countermeasures, they actually arguably have a duty to do so. There's been some argument about with legal scholars whether third-party states can take countermeasures, in other words, states that haven't been directly affected by Russia's war of aggression. And the answer is yes, this is actually well established in international law. There are numerous instances and numerous precedents of it. And that's because when a state's misconduct is so egregious, when it violates the very core norms of international law, like waging a war of aggression and committing genocide, it's considered to affect the entire global community, and any state has the right, and as I explained, also arguably even the duty to take countermeasures against it. So to go back to some of the disagreements, you would think, well, this is fairly well laid out. Some of the disagreement is that, well, what about sovereign immunity? Well, aren't Russia's sovereign assets untouchable? But let me be very clear about that. Sovereign assets are not untouchable. That's a legal fiction. That is absolutely a legal fiction. A state only benefits from non-interference with its property rights when it is abiding by international law. It's that simple. And in this case, Russia clearly is not. It's invaded Ukraine, it's stolen territory, it's stolen children, it's committed thousands of war crimes. So Russia doesn't now get to benefit from the rule of law for its bank account at the same time that it violates every single part of it. And it's not just me saying this. If you don't believe me, some of the world's leading scholars, practitioners, and experts from various countries have already established this legality in using state countermeasures. This is that argument. So basically, in a nutshell, when Russia stops its war and when it pays its reparations, the amount that it legally owes to Ukraine, then it can get the untouchability of its bank account back.
And on those war crimes, I mean, 10,000 war crimes are logged, and actually, many of the crimes committed in the occupied territories haven't even been researched yet because physically investigators can't get to them. So we're looking at 10,000 war crimes already, and that is potentially the tip of the iceberg. Are the international community sticking their head in the sand? Because to acknowledge the scale of illegality, to acknowledge the scale of brutality would demand action.
That's absolutely true, and it's actually far more than 10,000. The Ukrainian authorities, the prosecutor general, has recorded over 100,000 at this point, and I think that's not counting the occupied territories. That is a staggering number, and a lot of these aren't even recorded or known because they have to do with torture and sexual assault, and topics that victims aren't yet comfortable discussing or coming forward to. So yes, absolutely. The international community is sticking its head in the sand because I think recognizing this would necessitate this action. And it's frankly disgusting. It's disgusting that the Western world is turning a blind eye while the worst breaches of international law since World War II are happening in Europe's backyard.
And you know, war crimes, everyone watching this channel, I think, is aware of that, but just in case someone isn't, you know, these are war crimes that are certainly comparable to Nazi war crimes. We're talking about mass executions of civilians. We're talking about horrific crimes, which, you know, when these are fully investigated, I think many people, unfortunately, will be shocked by it, not those who are paying attention. But we are talking about a regime which is increasingly fascistic and which is also following a path of brutality. Now, of course, that led to the Nuremberg trials. That was taken relatively seriously, I would say, after the Second World War. Do you see a pattern here that the central bank assets are not happening? There are gaps and loopholes in the sanctions regime. It seems that the only proper enforcement of oil sanctions at the moment is Ukrainian drones. There is no effective, real embargo on Russian oil exports, and indeed, their oil exports has hit a high, and the price of Brent crude is actually going up because of all the issues with Houthis in the Red Sea and so on. Is there a pattern here of not doing what needs to be done in order to, one, ensure Ukrainian victory, but also, two, do it because it's the right thing to do it because it's the moral thing to do?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. There is another war crime that Russia continuously commits that I also want to bring some more attention to that I think isn't discussed enough. And that is the abduction of children, the abduction of Ukrainian children and their forced displacement into Russia and into military camps. It's horrific. There have already been arrest warrants issued for Putin and for his henchwomen who are orchestrating this. And this is a piece of the genocide puzzle. This is part of the genocide. There are 20,000 known cases, but estimates range to over 100,000 children stolen from Ukrainian territory from their parents. The only way to get these children back is to ensure a Ukrainian victory. We won't get these children back if Russia wins. So that's another one that I think really needs attention.
It's a huge one. We've done about four episodes now on the channel on this topic of the Ukrainian children who have been abducted. And of course, Russian propaganda will say, well, actually, they're not abducted and they're cared for and so on. But anyone who witnessed the tail end of the Soviet Union, anyone who talked to people who grew up in the Soviet Union and spent time in Soviet schools or went on those summer camps will know the kind of behaviors. And here we're talking about far more toxic behaviors even than then, because you've got the additional racism and so on that's been added into it, as well as the sort of Zed patriot cult. I think for those who understand that sort of Russian world, they'll start to get an inkling of the mental trauma, brainwashing, and in some cases violence, torture, which those children are subjected to.
Yeah, exactly. The Russian narrative is that, well, Russia's saving them and give it for humanitarian reasons. Even if, big if, that were true, there are international law standards by which it would need to abide by. There are four, and I apologize, I can't name all four off the top of my head, but one of them especially is telling people where these children are. Alerting authorities to, okay, we've removed this child due to their safety, and this is where they currently are. This is where we're holding them. This is what condition they're in, but we don't have that information. The world is definitely burying its head about it. I'm glad that your channel has spoken about this issue a lot, but it's sometimes disheartening to me to talk to some of my American friends who are so shocked to hear this.
It is, and of course, a lot of the comments we get on the channel are saying that Ukraine has almost disappeared from the mainstream media in the US. It's not nearly as prominent as I think it needs to be in the European and British media either. And when it does appear, that reporting is often, I would say, not particularly balanced, or there's poor choice of language and positioning of those stories. But that's a whole other topic. Let's get back to sanctions, and let's get back to the seizure of central bank assets. Another argument that's put forward is that the EU especially is holding off from taking this measure because it believes that this is a bargaining chip, that you can get Russia to the negotiating table, somehow you can enter into some rational argument based on rational principles if you hold these assets. Why do you think this is a spurious argument?
Well, it's an argument that's not based in any kind of reality. It's another example of nations burying their head in the sand and not recognizing the threat that Russia actually that plays here in the history of Russia either. So it's neither practical nor realistic to keep these assets as a bargaining chip, and I'll explain why. Usually the argument goes, we hold them for either one of two reasons. One, for Russia to cease its war, maybe end its war if it gets its assets back, or incentivizing Russia to pay the reparations that it owes. So it gets money back if it pays the reparations. Either one of those, if you give it a second of thought, is not practical. In terms of Russia ceasing its aggression, we've seen it's committed over 30% of its entire budget to its military action. It shows no signs of stopping the war. It has written off these assets. It's steadily growing its war machine. So using these assets as a way to persuade Russia to call off its war is just not plausible. It really doesn't make sense when you look at its entire goal is to eradicate the state of Ukraine. It doesn't care about 300 billion when it's already spent close, if not more than that amount, on its military goals. Second, using these frozen reserves as a bargaining chip for Russia to pay reparations, that also doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because leverage needs to be more than than what you want the other country to do. So leverage must be worth more than the value of what the other side seeks to lose. Russia already owes, by the most conservative estimate, 486 billion, according to the World Bank. That exceeds the amount of the frozen assets themselves. Why would Russia say, "Oh, okay, well, we'll pay close to 500 billion if we get 300 billion back"? It's simple math. Like it doesn't make sense. They're also, the bigger picture here too is that there can't be a scenario in which Russia gets its money back while its victims don't receive full compensation. So even if some kind of negotiated end to the war were to be brought about, I don't know how that would be, but suppose it would be unjust and unproductive if full compensation wasn't a part of that. You can't have peace without accountability, and part of that accountability is paying reparations to the victims. So this negotiation argument has been debunked so many times, but unfortunately, it just keeps coming back up. But even though it's pretty baseless.
So could these be used as a down payment on reparations? I mean, that presumes a freezing of the conflict. It presumes potentially even Ukrainian victory. But of course, I mean, I think it's unlikely at this point that Ukraine would be overrun and that there wouldn't be at least some sovereign government in one part of Ukraine. But there is a risk here, isn't there, that if Ukraine were to lose, then these funds who would you pay these back to? I mean, it's a bit of a can of worms when you kick that can down the road.
Exactly. I think you put it very, very well in terms of it being a down payment. It's important to recognize that this is an existing debt. This debt is not going to go away. Unlike what the Russian Foreign Ministry would like to have us believe, it's not theft of this money. We are not taking it. We are enforcing a debt. And it is in our best interest, and it's in Ukraine's best interest to enforce that debt now, while it can still make an outcome in the war itself. There is so much uncertainty in, again, waiting until the war is over, when we don't know what that would be like to start using these funds. Right now, they can still make a difference, and we need to capitalize on this moment.
Of course, Ukraine needs to unlock those funds now because of the drip feed of ammunition and so on. If Ukraine had the money, it could actually go to the market and purchase these things and speed up and make sure that supplies match the demand. There was an idea floated by the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron a couple of weeks ago that these central bank assets could be used as collateral for loans to the same amount. Now that seemed like an incredible idea. There was a bit of hoopla about it in the media, and I haven't seen any reference to that again. Is this a viable idea? And do you know if there are still discussions around using the assets as collateral for loans?
So I will start off by saying that I am very skeptical of this proposal. I'm sorry to disagree with you, but I don't think this is a brilliant idea. I think it is a half-baked, ineffective idea. It basically proposes issuing bonds to Ukraine that are, like you said, backed by frozen ocean assets. In other words, using them as collateral. So let me explain this a little bit and let me backtrack. Collateral functionally is there to be taken in case the borrower doesn't pay back their loans. So the idea is that if you're going to lend money to the Ukrainian state ordinarily, you probably demand pretty high interest rates. It's a country that's under attack, it's in debt, and it's unclear whether it can pay those loans back. But if you know that you can seize those assets as a backstop to pay Ukraine's debt, and in the case that Ukraine doesn't pay or that Russia isn't going to, then it becomes safer to issue those bonds. And so you don't have to demand a very high interest rate. But that kind of takes us back to the original problem, though. If you can't, as apparently government leaders and lawyers are saying, you can't legally confiscate the assets, how would you make good on that collateral? How would you seize the collateral? And the whole problem with this is that you can't collateralize something that you don't own. I haven't seen a very good way around that obstacle that wouldn't also solve the supposed original problem of why you can't just confiscate the assets to begin with, instead of going through this financial engineering rigmarole. So by trying to engineer around the issue, you're actually making it more legally, politically, and financially complicated. And you're also making it practically ineffective. So let me break it down even further. This is the scenario. You freeze, not seize, the 300 billion. And for at least 10 years, you tell investors that we want you to buy bonds guaranteed by the reparations that Putin will one day voluntarily pay. Or if Putin doesn't pay, then we guarantee it by our promise that we'll think about it and maybe we'll use the reserves to pay you back. But we're too scared to take them now. And so we can't promise you that we'll take them in the future, but we'd still like you to lend us money based on this. Here's a question. As an investor, how much money would you like to lend against this type of collateral? And here's another question. Even if you were willing to lend, what would that interest rate be? So the answer here is that either nobody lends or they lend it at a terribly high interest rate so that the 300 billion actually turns into something much smaller. So in terms of where this proposal is, I think the G7 led by the US has actually shifted into something worse, if that were even possible. So the US put out a variant of this, and the variant is to effectively collateralize not the assets, the principal amount of the assets themselves, but to collateralize the interest on the frozen assets themselves.
Much
So
smaller amount.
much smaller amount. So this is the leading scenario right now. And again, I'll break it down. You freeze, but not seize, the 300 billion for at least 10 years. And you tell investors that in 10 years, there will be 30 billion in interest. And so we'll sell you bonds where you get 30 billion in 10 years if you pay 20 billion now. The result, sure, is that Ukraine gets 20 billion now. But the bigger problem is that this locks up the principal amount of the assets. You can't seize the principal amount if you're collateralizing the interest. So it effectively turns 300 billion into 20 billion. It's like a magic trick that only the most weak leadership could come up with. And frankly, I'm disappointed to see that that's the best that we could do. The only way that I could think this could work is if the EU also guarantees the payment of the bonds by a certain date. If it actually makes that promise, this would actually put a real financial incentive for governments to one day take those assets if Russia hasn't paid reparations. So it does delay the seizure issue, but it makes investors comfortable and it gets Ukraine the money it needs now. So the collateral for the buyers would be the payment guarantee, and the collateral for the EU and the US would poetically be its will to seize the assets. But even still, I think that really just kicks the can down the road.
And it's a lot less money. It's 20 billion overall compared to 100 billion each year for 3 years, which would surely be enough to actually pay what needs to be paid to sustain the war, sustain, hospital infrastructure, fire services, and all of these that are under, tremendous pressure. Is it also true to say, this is one of the arguments I read, that legalistically the difficult bit has already been done? Freezing the assets is the tough bit. Confiscating them legalistically should not be such a, jumping through hoops.
Yes, that's exactly right. And actually, the freezing of the assets themselves was a countermeasure. Countries don't like to categorize it in that way. They call it a sanction, but under international law, no, it was a countermeasure. Because under international law, typically, you can't interfere with another sovereign's property, and that includes freezing it. So seizing it is simply another type of countermeasure. And one that is necessary right now. We've moved past the freezing stage. The freezing stage has not worked to cause Russia to change its mindset, to call off its war. So we need to think about more appropriate and more proportional ways of addressing this now.
The last question, I think, is probably quite a difficult one, but it is really what examples do we have in history that we should be basing policy on? Now, obviously, after the First World War, Germany was defeated. It was in a parlous state in terms of its economy, and so on, but it was forced to pay massive reparations for initiating the First World War. And after the Second World War, of course, Germany and Japan were occupied. And whatever terms were made upon them were forced upon them by the occupying powers. They were in no position to resist those, and indeed their entire political system, society, etc., were re-engineered so that these kind of whatever reparations there were sort of baked in and accepted by the political class. And of course, there was an acceptance that their aggressive imperial behaviour was wrong, and there was a generations-long process of re-education. Now, that seems to me the context for putting in place sustainable reparations. At this point, there seems to be very little chance of being able to impose similar conditions on Russia.
So you do bring up a good precedent about World War II, and yes, that's a good one, but it's a little bit different from what we have now, where we need to respond to this war not generations later, but immediately. There is actually a precedent. There are numerous, but I think a good one is during the Gulf War, when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. In 1992, the U.S. and others, I think the UK, France, and other states actually adopted countermeasures against Iraq, and they suspended Iraq's immunity in order to compensate the victims of Iraq's aggression. So, in the case of the US, the president issued an executive order based entirely on laws that we already have now on the books to direct US banks holding frozen Iraqi state funds into an escrow account. And those frozen funds were then moved to a claims commission under the direction of the UN Security Council. So the main point that people bring up in terms of this precedent is like, well, we don't have the UN Security Council here. And yes, we don't have the UN Security Council here for obvious reasons. However, but this is an example of countermeasure being used. And we don't, under countermeasures, we don't need the Security Council. In fact, the whole point of countermeasures, as described by the international lawyer James Crawford, who wrote the articles on responsibility, is that they're meant to be decentralized acts by states. They're not meant to be institutionalized. They are a self-help measure in exactly situations like this where institutions have failed. For example, when the aggressor sits on the Security Council. And here actually we do have something synonymous. We have the UN General Assembly resolution, which was adopted in November 14th, 2022, under the what's called the Uniting for Peace formula. This Uniting for Peace mechanism is specifically meant to address situations where the Security Council can't act or it has been rendered functionless. So it's a substitute for it. And that UN resolution specifically called upon Russia to bear the legal consequences of its wrongful acts and for member states to establish an international compensation mechanism. So we do have precedents. Again, the Iraq one is a good one. And yes, there are differences. But that's fine. You can't really say, well, we don't have an exact blueprint. And that's because, well, history doesn't give us blueprints. Sometimes things are unprecedented. And unfortunately, we are in an unprecedented situation. And so we must respond accordingly. And we do that by looking at precedents from the past and analogizing as best we can. So the situation that we find ourselves in is that we are setting a precedent for the future. We are in a situation where we need to adapt, where we need to take the most appropriate course of action. And that's either by action or inaction. No matter what, we are setting a precedent. So the decisions that we take today matter. They will either vindicate international law, or they'll reduce it to a self-defeating body of rules that prioritizes a country's bank account over reparations for the worst breaches of international law that have already been condemned by the international community. So how we respond to this question will determine our collective values going forward. And that's why it's so important. And that's why we can't let, well, there hasn't been an exact situation like this before, stop us from taking necessary action.
And we're back to political will. We're back to the idea of whether tyranny should be opposed, whether rules should be upheld and standards of human rights, or whether those tyrants should be appeased. And I think it's back to that relatively simple question there. Yulia, it's been such a huge pleasure talking to you. You've shed light on so many issues that we've touched upon on the channel, but given such incredibly clear and forceful answers to those. Thank you so much for spending time in sharing your expertise and insights with us. I definitely hope to follow up with you on this story in future months, hopefully when we'll see some progress on it. But thank you so much. Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава. Thank you.